A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey guys, you ever wonder what Phil and I wear while we podcast? You can find out if you join our Patreon. We'll also be talking about the films of 1989, but that's definitely less important than seeing our Zoom backgrounds, our headphone choices, and our sweatshirts.
It's true. It's true. You'll get to see all the various pieces of artwork that I have framed on my office wall, and you can see Kenny's garden, sort of. So that's something. That's exciting.
It's a hanging garden.
It's a hanging garden. But perhaps more important than anything, we are doing this Patreon to cover the best films of 1989. Batman, When Harry Met Sally, Indiana Jones, The Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, with amazing guests like Tom Meissen, Liz Hanna, Joanna Robinson, Brian Cogman, Chuck Hayward. You can sign up at patreon.com/podcastlikeit's1989. And for $5, you'll get access to all the audio of these fantastic episodes. For a few bucks more, you'll get video as well of our 99 and 89 episodes. And perhaps, most importantly, you'll be supporting us so we can just keep making podcast content for you guys.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1999 falling off a bookshelf here in 2021. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Nybart.
And I'm Phil Iskov.
And with us today is, hello, Aaron LaRosa. You just heard her voice.
Like, do I introduce myself?
No. You're here. You're back. It's been a while. It's been a beat.
It has been a while.
Been a beat. How you been?
You know, I have a toddler now, so my life has changed a lot.
Yes, you know, I have a 16-year-old now.
Oh, that's fucked up.
I don't have a 16-year-old.
He doesn't have a 16-year-old.
No.
Great.
No.
I would believe it. I'd be like, yeah, Kenny. Doesn't Kenny have, like, how many kids? It's a lot of kids.
Four kids.
That's like a circus of kids.
Yes.
And I feel like, Kenny, you've had a kid since Aaron was last on. Am I
crazy?
Seems
like it. Seems like
it feels like that. Feels like that.
How old is your youngest kid?
Two.
Oh, okay. Because mine is 16 months.
Okay. So,
I mean,
do you know how many kids I have staying at my house right now?
I'm going to guess 13.
No, but I no joke, had 13 kids over yesterday.
Oh, my God.
Because
one of my best friends who moved to France. Probably 8 or 9 years ago, is staying with us with his two kids, two little French kids. It's the best.
Well, that's cute.
And two little French
also, kids. My niece is staying here, is 13. So we have seven kids currently staying at my house, and four adults.
Now, is this a daycare? Can I send my daughter to your house later today?
You can, because this is going to be the average over the next 3 weeks. Is that
okay,
my sister-in-law is coming with her other three kids, including, so that's four, including the one
one of her kids who's staying. So we'll have eight. And then my other sister-in-law is going to be coming with her three kids the following week. So we'll be back down to seven.
Great.
And then I'm, if I survive, I will be running off to the hills for a few days and no one will ever be able to find me.
We'll just tack my baby in there and that'll be eight.
There you go. It's perfect.
It's a nice
It's a real ensemble piece here, Phil.
Oh, Jesus. It is.
Ensemble. With a lot of sisters that you may not know are sisters until the last act.
Well, first of all, I want to say, Aaron, the last time you were here, we talked about a masterpiece, right? I believe you were here for Dudley Do Right the last time you were on this
podcast. Yeah, I was here. And
a movie that
still lingers with me.
Laps this film 10 times over. It's.
But yes, I remember you being kind of Luke on Dudley, but I feel like you must be a little warmer, maybe even hot on it now.
Well, now I am. If we're comparing, like if you're like, which movie would you want to rewatch? I'd be like, obviously Dudley. Going in.
100%. 100%. Wait,
I want to say one more thing, Aaron.
Yeah.
So I think it's been about 3 years since you've been on this podcast.
I believe
two and a half, 3 years.
Yeah.
In those right. 2.5, 3 years, Brendan Fraser has gone from an obsession of just the three of us to Hollywood's favorite son. Everybody's on this Fraser tip that we started on this pod. It's true.
We have a really big impact. This is culture, okay? Yeah. And we make it on this podcast.
You are listening to some influencers right now. So
I mean, how many times did we talk about Brendan Fraser? I was on your podcast. I think that was maybe the only Brendan. Blast from the Past. Because I was like, I think I've just brought him up randomly on other podcasts of yours, but no, it was Blast from the Past.
He's really. I know that Kenny believes he's going to get an Oscar nomination.
Everything.
I think The Whale could very well get him an Oscar nomination, Kenny. We don't know what the movie is yet. Blah blah blah, but. Yeah, he showed up in No Sudden Move. He's great in No Sudden Move, the Soderbergh HBO Max thing.
He's been killing it recently.
Yeah, he's really
good. He deserves every good thing in the world. And I'm so happy that we brought him back just through this podcast.
Oh, yes. we definitely did. There's no question about that. I think, you know, look, we live in a world where Simon Rex might win an Oscar. Yeah. You never know what's going to happen. Right. Yeah. But look, Brendan Fraser's ticking all the boxes. He's working with a director.
He always has. That's what I've been telling you guys.
The man ticks the boxes.
He understood the assignment from day one.
He's working with a director for whom Natalie Portman, I can't think of any others, but he's directed people to best actor, actress trophies before.
Mm-hmm.
He is going to weigh 600 pounds, I believe.
Correct.
People love a physical transformation. No one does like BF, my BF.
Your BF. Yeah.
And I think people really want to do the thing where, you know, Hollywood feels like we brought him back. But anyone who knows, this podcast brought him back. Just like we're about to do for Jay Moore.
I was just going to ask, is there someone you would want to bring back from this cast?
Okay.
Nobody in this cast was injured by this. Everybody in this cast
went on
to do even more incredible.
I actually have a list of the cast in my notes because there are so many. I was looking through them. I was like, okay, Gillian Anderson is fine. Sean Connery, R.I.P. Angelina Jolie.
I guess everyone's fine. But I hear you, Kenny. It is definitely, this is one of those movies that, like, I remember when this film came out. I remember feeling like, wow, that's a really impressive cast. And then it just kind of disappeared. And I've never really thought about it since. I want to sort of ask a grander question at the top of this episode, which is sort of.
All right. The movie we're doing is called Playing by Heart.
It's Playing by Heart. Correct.
You all remember it?
Everyone's favorite ensemble. There are lots of movies, or there's a genre, if you will, of this type of film, right? The
bad films.
Well, I was going to say the sort of mosaic of characters, interconnected characters of an ensemble. And this is the nadir of that. Like, this is the worst inclinations of all of... like, there's a reason why you set out to make this type of film. A Shortcuts, a Magnolia, you know what I mean? A whatever, right? Where you sit down and you're like, I want to talk about all these different stories, and each of them are specific and interesting in a way that I feel like they speak to each other. This does none of that. There's no specificity to this film. There's nothing about this movie that stays with you. There's no reason to write this fucking script other than the fact that this... Sorry, go ahead. Please, Aaron. Please.
No, I was just wondering how he got these folks to sign on to the movie, because I think it's a series of monologues. That's what it feels like I'm watching a stage play. But... Yeah,
but monologues don't say anything.
They don't. But how did he get them to sign on to this? What was the trick? Like, maybe one person signed on and they were like, we got Sean Connery, you got to join this movie. Or I don't know what it was.
Not only did he get him to sign on, he got Sean Connery to sign on for $50,000.
For like nothing.
What?
This is Sean Connery, who in the same year is probably getting paid like $10 million. Correct. To do what's the shitty movie we hate? The
Entrapment.
Yeah, another shitty movie.
So this movie cost $14 million, and everyone in the cast took significant pay cuts or was paid what Sean Connery was paid, which is $50,000. So Connery, the director, I'll quote the director here because he says, according to director Willard Carroll, the film was made for $14 million. Cast was led by Sean Connery, were agreed to $50,000. Carroll praised Connery, saying that he continued his total democratic cooperation in the ensemble piece. He was the most generous actor, although he is larger than life star, and that Connery set the example for the rest of the cast. My assumption is that Connery was the key to all of this, right? Like, he's the key that gets all of these people to sign on. I'm assuming, right?
I would assume that too. He's
not the fucking script.
No, and also, I mean, what I will say is there was this scene where Sean Connery does a little dance. Do you remember that scene? Oh, he dances out of a room, and I was like, I can't imagine ever seeing Sean Connery do this again. So maybe this movie is worth it just for him doing a little like silly dance out of a room.
Just to be clear, I'm thrilled we're covering this because I, as you can assume, I hated it and I'd love to talk about it. And I'm glad that I feel like what's interesting about this, Kenny, and you can obviously stop me or disagree with me, but I want to kind of put it next to Magnolia in a lot of ways, because Magnolia is obviously the success of all of these things.
Yes.
And what this film is just not even attempting to do anything. This movie makes Crazy Stupid Love look like fucking Citizen Kane. Like, it really, and I don't even really love Crazy Stupid Love, but like, Crazy Stupid Love does the same reveal at the end, and everyone's minds were blown by it.
Well, not everyone, but Crazy Stupid Love is a terrible movie, and I agree, it does look like Citizen Kane next to this. It's just a terrible, miserable film.
Can we talk about Ryan Phillippe's blue hair?
Which he did on his own volition. He just showed up one day with his hair dyed, and they were like, how cute. And then apparently...
No, you're just kidding. You're I'm making not. That up.
He showed up with blue hair, and they were like, great. I mean, so fuck it. I want to kind of... I'm going to give a synopsis of this because I don't think anybody saw this movie because it made no money. But in the tale of how love binds 11 random people from Los Angeles, a married couple played by Sean Connery and Gina Rowlands prepare to renew vows. A widowed mother played by Ellen Burstyn cares for her dying son played by Joey Moore. A couple played by Madeline Stowe and Anthony Edwards have an affair. A theater director played by Gillian Anderson strikes up a relationship with a stranger played by Jon Stewart. An aspiring actress played by Angelina Jolie pursues a shy young man and a lone man, talks of heartbreak to strangers playing by heart. So here, I got to be, to our listeners, this one slipped through the cracks. We are not going to start covering films that were released at the end of 98 for Oscar consideration. This film opened widely on January 22nd, 1999. It did get released in two theaters in New York and LA on December 25th. So 5 days before the end of 1998.
We really fucked up.
We fucked up.
In many
we fucked
ways.
Up. It shouldn't have. It's a 98 film. Technically, it sort of eked into 98. We're covering it anyway. Don't add us. It is what it is. We're gonna. I mean, who gives?
We're not doing Rushmore.
We're not doing Rushmore. We're not doing any other films that slipped into 98, but this one did. So whatever, it is what it is.
Yeah.
It goes on to make $3.9 million on an $18 million budget. Angelina Jolie won an award for Best Breakthrough Performance by an Actress at the National Board of Review. And the writer-director Willard Carroll was nominated for an award at the Berlin International Film Festival. It's got 60% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics, 79% from audiences. Roger Ebert said, it's easy to like the movie because we like the actors in it and because the movie makes it easy on us and has charming moments. But it feels too much like an exercise. It's yuppie, light, affluent, articulate people who, except for those who are ill, have problems that are almost pleasant. It has been observed that a lot of recent movies about death have gone all soft and gooey at the center. Here's a movie about life that does the same thing. Yeah, I mean, I don't disagree with that.
Can I say that I kind of understand how Angelina Jolie got nominated for something? Because out of the whole movie, at least in her scenes, she was really trying or bringing something, some kind of energy where I was like, oh, I will watch more scenes with her and her one-eyed cat Blanche. Like, I will surely tune into those. Like, let's just do a movie on that.
She's the best actress maybe who's ever lived. So yes, she obviously, like, you know, proved that again. The most beautiful woman in the world playing someone who can't get a date is pretty convincingly.
Really
pretty
impressive. Really great.
I think there's also she's proven this many times since in her career, which is that she can defy the words that she's saying, right? Like, she's saying legitimate.
That's what the best actors and actresses can do.
Absolutely, right? She's taking bad dialogue and she is somehow imbuing it with charm and watchability and you know, charisma. And you're just sort of, I mean, the movie opens with her, obviously, because the movie knows what it has in her. I mean, it knows that, like, she's the only one that we probably are going to care about. Maybe, I don't know. And it does this stupid fucking in media res fracture narrative thing for no reason. Like, no reason. But it starts with in the middle of a scene with her, and we know it's going to be Ryan Felipe, but whatever. So it starts in the middle of a scene with her talking about fucking dancing to architecture or something like that, because that was
Dancing about architecture
or whatever. And then it folds back on itself. It loops back around, I don't know, an hour or so into this interminably long movie. Like, this movie felt really long.
How long is it?
It's 2 hours.
It did feel longer.
It's a painfully stupid idea. The idea that the thesis statement of this movie is talking about love is like dancing about architecture. Mm-hmm. Dancing about architecture. Texture.
Words lost all meaning.
And then texture, and then proceeding to talk about love for the next 2 hours is so painfully stupid to me.
Yes.
But the thesis is stupid. Talking about love is not like dancing about architecture. Nor is it like writing about music, which is allegedly what the original
Lou Reed
quote is, which is also a stupid fucking comparison. Of course, you can write about music. Of course, you can talk. These are mediums, that have the ability to express the way you feel in a way that dancing really doesn't. And by the way, you probably could fucking dance about texture.
I agree with you, because what's kind of crazy about it is, in this monologue that she gives at the top of the movie, she basically says, there's no point in talking about love for all intents and purposes because it's beyond, you know what I mean? Like, it's beyond any of those things. Like, it's some sort of otherworldly thing. So then why are you making a fucking 2-hour movie about it if it's like, it doesn't make any sense. It's like you're shooting yourself in the foot.
Willard Carroll proved that there's no point for him to talk about
that. That's true. That's true.
Because he does not understand what it is. Now, I think it's interesting because the other movie that has to be brought up is Love Actually.
Yes.
Which I wonder if you think is Citizen Kane next to this as well.
I agree. And I don't like Love Actually at all.
Way more watchable. than this movie.
Well, sure.
Love Actually is charming. There are charming parts of Love Actually.
Yes.
The baseline
dialogue, the baseline dynamic, the baseline, you know, level of interaction between the characters in Love Actually is significantly higher. My understanding, and Phil, you, as a Love Actually hater, please correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that among the haters, it's not so much the micro that bothers people. It's more the macro. It's more the structure and more the tweeness and the silliness and the way things kind of like everything works out. Or I know some people, you know, hate the Keira Knightley story, which I understand, but does not seem to be like, you know, the point of why you hate a movie. The baseline of Love Actually is highly competent, and Richard Curtis and friends have proven that they are highly competent when it comes to, you know, having two people talk to each other and believable and, you know, relatable
People talk to each other.
I used to say that Love Actually is Magnolia for dumb people, but this is truly Magnolia for dumb people. Love Actually, and I don't think that Love Actually, and I have watched it relatively recently again, and I liked it a lot more the last time that I watched it.
During the pandemic, I
do like Richard Curtis. I think Notting Hill is fantastic. I think that Richard Curtis has a specificity that this film has. Like, this movie is the most damning thing I can say is how it lacks in any specificity. Like, there's really nothing that's interesting about any of these characters. Whereas Love Actually, whether or not I like the Colin Firth storyline, whether or not I like all the storylines, that's fine. Great. I don't dislike Colin Firth. I think that storyline's just stupid, but that's whatever.
The best.
I think that some of the stuff that works in Love Actually works incredibly well. Works so much better than anything in this movie. That, you know what I mean? They shouldn't even really be talked about in the same conversation, even though I understand where we are. I think that one of the things that should be said, Willard Carroll, the director of this film, had done nothing and continued to do nothing that made it seem as though he could make this movie. I don't know if you guys looked at his credits.
I did. And I was,
they are
I
all also kids was films. Like,
what? Yeah, but it's okay, did he television. Do The Brave Little Toaster, the he original the movie?
What do you because guys know that about made The me Brave cry. Little Toaster?
I know that I cried. I know that the toaster nearly died in an incinerator. Is that right?
Correct.
That's what I remember.
It sounds like Toy Story owes a debt of gratitude to this Brave Little Toaster.
So Brave Little Toaster was a very intense movie.
To be clear, he did not write or direct The Brave Little Toaster. He executive produced the first one.
And then
wrote the sequels and directed the sequels, I believe.
Okay.
So he started as an executive producer. That's where most of his credits are. He then directed a movie called The Runstone. I don't know what that is. Then he does this film. Then he does a children's film called Tom's Magic Garden. And then he does Midnight Garden. And then he does another film called Marigold. Long story short is that there's nothing in Willard Carroll's credits that would lead you to believe that he could make this movie, write this movie, direct this movie, yet he did, and then proved why he should not have done any of these
things. He and Sean Connery must have been friends or something.
I guess. Maybe.
They must have been. How else?
Him and Harvey Weinstein. It seems like... All right, so you look at him. This guy is not some film student or some random guy living somewhere who, you know, wrote a spec, which is what this feels like. This feels like a dummy's spec, right? Like a dummy being like, my family's interesting and I should just write about my family. And when you really look at it on paper, all his family has are some people who have been in relationships with other people. And that is kind of like what humans. A family is.
Yeah, like so what people what, do.
Yeah, you look at a family tree, that is the story of any family tree. Some people made some people. So it does seem like he just said, you know, it would be interesting, the story of my life, and also a bad retelling of one part of Philadelphia. And
yes,
And someone bought it, and someone bought into it and said, like, let's go ahead and do it. Now, like, the thing that upsets me and kind of bugs me and bothers me is that I like these kind of movies in theory.
Same. Yes.
Right? Like, yes. I think these are high wire acts. I think the best ones are Shortcuts and Magnolia and Nashville. And these are brilliant movies. Like,
yes.
Brilliant, like painfully brilliant movies. I think when they're done poorly, you get to that place where executives and producers and critics and people start saying, don't even try. Don't even try to make a movie like this. It's too hard.
Yes. Yes.
And that bugs me so much because you don't mm-hmm. see like big ensembles like this. I mean, Boogie Nights is a big ensemble like this. Big ensembles like this get made very often.
Well, now so. It's, I mean, now, so I do feel like, I mean, two things come to mind when you, what you were saying, Kenny. The first is this movie also made me think about like a bad James L. Brooks movie too, right? Like a bad sort of, you know, rich white people problems and just sort of this, you know, a lot of that kind of, it kind of made me think of Spanglish a little bit, you know, of that kind of thing. Hmm. Of to your point, Kenny, like, yeah, I don't like it particularly either. But that idea of like someone taking a step back from their life and being like, you know what, my life's pretty interesting. I should just make a movie about my life. And you're like, your life's not that interesting. The second thing is that,
by the way, like everyone's life is interesting. Like that's the thing is like, to you, like I mean, everyone's life is interesting if you have the guts to tell the real story.
Totally,
right? Like the story of I met someone and we kind of didn't like each other and now we kind of do like each other is not that interesting.
I agree.
But you could, if you interrogate any relationship, anybody's life, like, and you execute it well. Yeah, it almost always is really fucking compelling.
I totally agree.
So
there's also the Crazy Stupid Love thing. I do think kind of opened the door a little bit. And then we got This Is Us, which is obviously the same writer. You know, this idea of like the interconnectedness of lives and withholdings, you know, for reveals and stuff like that. I'm sort of surprised we haven't seen more movies like this, I guess, is what I'm getting at.
You know, one movie recently, and it's not that recent anymore, it's 5 years ago, that reminded me of this is that movie Collateral Beauty.
Oh, God.
Where you pull together all these big stars, you get them to do, you know, a week on set or whatever it is.
I saw that in the theater.
Yeah. And it, you know, like no one really buys that it's some kind of actual Oscar play. But like the studio is like, we got all these great actors. We got, you know, I'm looking at it. We got Will Smith. We got Keira Knightley. Yeah. We got
Kate Winslet, Edward Norton.
Edward Norton, Michael Pena, Naomi Harris. I mean, everyone I'm naming has been nominated for Oscars. It's some Helen Mirren nominated or won, written by Alan Loeb, you know, directed by
the
David
end of
Frankel.
That, the reveal that they're angels at the end of that movie is
that's
a
very
doozy.
Upsetting. It's a very upsetting.
I'm going to have to watch this movie now.
You need to watch Collateral Beauty. I actually, Aaron, I really want you to because I need to hear what you think of it. If you thought this... If this movie made you wonder, what is this movie? That movie will absolutely blow your mind. I want to kind of
when you have these ensemble pieces that don't really follow narrative or one cohesive narrative, you usually wrap it around something. Now, like the worst of these are the Gary Marshall movies, the
Mother's Day and Valentine's Day,
and whatever, and that's very embarrassing. The the best, I mean, like Magnolia, is about a feeling, right? The Magnolia is about this kind of pervasive feeling of the apocalypse coming upon all of these characters, and everybody's a little heightened, and you don't really know why until the end of the movie, like exactly what it is that's like, you know, tying everybody's stomach into knots in this film. But this movie's about fucking nothing. And by the way, so is Crazy Really, Really Stupid Love.
Stupid
That's
love.
What I call it. Really Stupid Love.
Didn't we talk about how the reveal is all around the fact that they call Emma Stone's
Nana.
Character Nana, which makes no sense.
It's actually worse than Anger Ball. but
the thing about Magnolia is that it's biblical, right? Like it's larger than it's the whole human condition, right? Like it's humanity. Whereas this movie is just about like, I'm not happy.
I think he must have thought it was just about love and that was enough. That it's just about different kinds of love. And he was like, this is, I'm going to show a mother's love. I'm going to show a marriage falling apart. I'm going to show single people. Like he just kind of ticked all the boxes and was like the love. And here are the different kinds.
And I think that's what, I think that's probably was the, which I think that was the pitch, which is, by the way, that's exactly what Love Actually is, right? That's exactly Love Actually. So it's, it does so much come down to, it actually is all around.
It really does come down to execution.
It just does. It really just comes down to execution.
Yep.
And in this particular case, it comes down to scope. I mean, there's not a particular. There are four examples of love, right? There's an old married couple. There's a married couple it's on the rocks. Five. You have someone falling in love. You have unrequited love, and you have a mother's love. Those are all pretty rote. Also, pretty heteronormative. Also, you know. Just things we've seen a million, like movies dedicated to in the old course, at least in, Love Actually, the Laura Linney storyline is unusual. The storyline with Martin Freeman, I think is kind of unusual. The storyline with Liam Neeson and his stepson is very unusual. That feels familiar, but I don't know if I can remember a movie about that particular kind of relationship.
This comes back sort of what I was saying earlier, you know, which is that there is a specificity to Richard Curtis's writing that he is, you know, he's found
it actually is all around.
Sure.
That's what the movie's about.
But there's also his ability to be able to sort of the universality in that specificity is where obviously that's why these movies hit, right? Whereas this film is trying to be so universal that it's just milquetoast, right? Like it's just applesauce. None of it actually means anything to anybody.
I like applesauce.
I don't dislike applesauce, but I mean, my point is that
it needs a little cinnamon on it.
It needs, exactly. There you go.
This movie needs a little cinnamon.
This movie needs any fucking spice. It's kind of, like I was, first of all, I would say probably 20 minutes, half an hour into this film, I checked to see how much time there was left. And I was like, oh, fuck. Like it really was an interminable film. But what's interesting, Kenny, is you talked about execution. One of the things that I actually find really muddled in this film, I have no idea the passage of time. There's times when I think it could be hours. There's times where it could be fucking days. You just have no idea what's actually transpiring when. And because of that, the passage of time helps you in terms of creating stakes, in terms of creating, you know, temporal ideas of what's going on. Dennis Quaid's entire thing feels like it's one night, but it's not.
A week. No. They said it's like a week of making pretend other people, but that is dropped at the end. And let me tell you, I had no idea what was going on until the very end when Angelina Jolie was like, how was that improv class where you every night pretend to be a different person for a week? And I was like, that's what was happening.
I feel so bad for Dennis Quaid in this movie.
It's some of the most embarrassing material I've ever seen. I was so confused the whole time. I was like, okay, so he ran over his wife with a car, and then I'm like, oh wait, his wife's cheating on him, and I was like, and now he's at a gay bar and he's pretending that he slept with his wife's brother, and I was like, is something? I was just really, really confused the entire time until the very end.
No, I was very, very confused until the very end. But then with the reveal at the end, do you think that Dennis Quaid was acting like a bad actor? Like, do you think that was part of what he was doing?
like when he did improv, he was trying to
show
that he was a bad actor. Now that is interesting. That
first scene, and obviously we'll never know, but that first scene is so jarringly bad.
Yes.
That you're just like, wait a fucking second.
Well,
even the drag queen at the drag bar is like, I know that you're straight. Okay.
Well, what's and really interesting.
It was great.
You guys are hitting on something really interesting to me. And then I've kind of a macro theory about this movie and how it okay. extends to other movies. But I'll start in the micro, which is that scene is terrible. It's a nightmare. The scene where Dennis Quaid comes in, I believe it's Patricia Clarkson.
It is Patricia Clarkson.
That he basically, you know, is crying at a bar and saying his wife and children died in a car accident or cancer or cancer
that
accident.
He drove the car into them.
Right.
Yeah, okay. he hit them.
Yes, yes.
While drunk.
So that scene is so bad, and there is no indication, except maybe what you guys are talking about, that it's not real until final analysis of the movie. So,
yes,
like you guys, I'm watching this movie and I'm thinking, oh, so this is just a horrible movie. Like this is just a like so there's no like there is no benefit to keeping quiet what you're doing. All you're doing is making the audience think this is a horrible shit movie that I don't want to be with. Now, second point. When you have a reveal like this, or like in Crazy Stupid Love, 2/3, 3/4, 4/5, 5/6 of the way through the movie, you reveal that everything you thought you knew about those characters should be viewed in a through a different lens because something has changed about the relationship to each other. What you're doing is, to me, is you're saying actually what we wrote throughout the entire film was not strong enough to stand on its own two legs. Yep. So we have to put some ridiculous ending on this that is ultimately inconsequential for the characters.
Yep.
It is only consequential for you, the viewer, the way you watch this, right? You would never tell the story of this family and say, all right, so let me tell you a story about four people. And then at the end say, and would you believe it? The reason they all use the term gamer ball is because their mom invented it. All right. So furthermore, the irony of this whole thing to me is if you had started the film with these characters in the same place and said all four of these characters or five of these guys, I guess it really is the mother, the three daughters, and like one of their ex-husbands, Jay Moore, that's the relationships between them. If you had said all four of these,
is Ellen Burstyn her sister? Sorry, I can't remember.
I don't know about that. Jay Moore is Gillian Anderson's ex-husband.
Okay.
So who was actually gay and contracted?
Oh, and I didn't realize they were married. I thought she was just the last guy I dated. Turned out to be
and
gay.
I think they all still kind of like Jay Moore, right?
Sure.
And that's why he's still like kind of in their lives in a way. And that's, I think Ellen Burstyn is at the wedding at the end because of that, or she's not, or whatever. Point being,
Jillian does have a type though. Jon Stewart does have a Jay Moore vibe.
I actually think he's so charming in this, but that's just maybe me. Like he's just so fucking charming.
Yeah.
But and she's awesome too. Like they could have had their own movie.
But separately
this movie, with this writer.
I didn't like them necessarily in scenes together because I kept thinking, why is Jon Stewart like repeatedly going back to Jillian, who has made it very clear.
I'm not into this.
And
also she had a bookcase dropped on her, which I was really not okay with. I was like, how does she walk away from that?
Yeah.
She just stood back up and was like, I'm
fine.
I agree
with everything you're saying.
Anyways.
All right. But the point I'm making.
Yes. Sorry.
Some of the great fucking movies of all time are about siblings and people who are related having their own fucking stories. Mm-hmm. For instance, The Magnificent Ambersons is about this.
Sure.
Hannah and her sisters is this. Mm-hmm. Could you imagine if in the end of Hannah and her sisters, the reveal, there was a reveal that they're all sisters? You would be like, what the fuck did we just watch? Why didn't you just tell me that? But because you don't have that, that weird, what are we doing here thing, you can actually just sit back and watch the film transpire. Well, it's so stupid to me. that you think that anybody would think that kind of storytelling reveal just for the benefit of the audience is actually an aha. Like anybody who had their mind blown by Crazy Stupid Love actually is a dummy. Sorry.
I think that I don't disagree with anything you're saying, and you're tapping into something that does seem to be a little is a little pervasive right now, which is a lot of people's frustrations with television shows that tend to do the jump ahead and then come back. And then, you know, you have a season of television or multiple seasons that are catching up to that point that they've told you about deeper in the run. Now, the issue that people have with that is similar to what you're saying, Kenny, which is the confidence in storytelling in their theory is that you should be confident in the characters, confident in the story you're telling, so you don't need to hoodwink me, quote unquote, with this sort of, you know, fractured narrative in media res thing. I don't particularly subscribe to that because I don't think it's that binary.
That's not the same.
I know, but I'm glomming onto is Hand in Her Sisters is a great film because that movie has the confidence to say, I'm telling a story about these sisters and I'm going to tell it well, and I'm going to tell a good movie. Yes. This movie doesn't have that confidence. So it's dangling these weird sort of modifiers and kind of mysteries because it's afraid that it doesn't have your attention, and it doesn't. So
well, I think back to that spec script thing. I think it was just like, he was like, and you know, it'll be a cool ending. They're all connected. They're related. Like, I think
he's the first fucking person to
probably,
think of that. Yeah.
Of course, because you had no guts. But I think, yeah. I mean, I want to just comment on what you're saying about the fractured narrative and it's, you know, jumping back to some moment in the future. White Lotus does that.
Yeah.
And I've been thinking about that.
I love White Lotus. Yeah.
Yeah, I do too.
I've only seen the first episode. Okay. No spoilers.
I'm not going to say anything else. I mean, it's the first scene of the first episode where you find out that, you know, someone died. And then you find out that we're going back 6 weeks or something, or 2 weeks or 1 week. You go back 1 week. That's it. So, and I'm thinking about why that works. Cause in general, I kind of am allergic to this trope. I do think it is often a cheat, but in this show, it feels like a Trojan horse to me. Like
100%.
It's Trojan horsing me personally to continue with this show. Cause I want to find something out. And along the way, I am meeting these characters who I love so much and I'm finding so fucking compelling that it's not that this mystery is melting away, but it is certainly riding side saddle to 100%. The stories of what's happening with these characters. So it does so in a way that, like, for instance, Succession didn't do. Succession for the first 5 or 6 episodes was a bit of a...
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Trudge.
Who's gonna? Yeah.
It was a bit of a trudge as you're like learning the rhythms of the characters and learning the relationships and again, I think Succession is the best show on TV. So don't think I'm shitting on Succession.
Do you think I love so too, Aaron? Succession. Yeah, we should just do a whole podcast about Succession.
I do. I think it's the best show. I think it's as good as, you know, the classic fucking golden age shows that we always hold up. But I do think like those 4 or 5, it's like the first 100 pages of a novel where you're like, you have to get through the first 100 and then the rewards are plentiful.
I hate when people say that. Isn't that terrible? Like, who has the time to spend 100 pages and you're not invested in something? But yeah, go on.
But often it's worth it. I do is think it? Like, yeah. Well, I hate reading in general. I'm with you, Aaron. Reading is for you.
I don't think that's what Aaron's saying.
I am a novelist.
She's a novelist.
My dear reading. Reading is the worst. But yes, thank you, Kenny. I know that you'll buy my book, though, when it's out.
I'll actually read it. I'm reading the book for Becky Feldman's
podcast. Oh, that's great. Are you loving
right
it?
Now.
And which book?
I'm reading. It's called Barista.
It's about a bear who's a barista.
It's about a shapeshifter who shapeshifts into a bear who becomes a barista.
This is the Too Stupid to Live podcast about romance books.
Yes, that's
it's so great. And you're going to be great on that podcast.
Becky is so generously giving me like 2 months to read this like 120 page romance novel because reading is hard for Kenny.
Can I just say though, Kenny, to your point earlier about I completely lost the thread. I apologize.
No, I was talking about the White Lotus.
White Lotus. My point about White Lotus was I will not be surprised if by the end of White Lotus, this body is completely meaningless. Like that's ultimately, do you know what I mean? That whoever the person is not that it's not going to be meaningless, that it's not going to have meaning, but that it doesn't ultimately matter in the greater scheme of things.
It's an interesting thing because I'll tell you, by the end of Mayor of Easttown, I couldn't have cared less about the crime.
Who the killer was, yeah, sure.
And I really loved the character so much and felt like that was worth it. By the end of True Detective, they put so much stock into the crime that I was severely let down, even though the characters were super compelling. So it is this delicate balance of, you know, how much stock you put into the crime or the mystery and how much you build your characters. And to me, it's almost like this magical alchemy that you probably can't even forecast. But
it's interesting because it does feel like the Angelina Jolie scene at the top of this movie feels like what it's trying to do, to your point, Kenny, is allude to something bigger, some connective thing, perhaps, that makes these stories all sort of come together. But I mean, okay, take Magnolia, for instance, right? Magnolia opens with a series of short vignettes that explain how, whether we like it or not, our lives are somewhat interconnected and that there's something that's bringing these things together. So
you can't
be
just one of those things.
Can't just be one of those things. This did happen. So there's a part of me that feels like, you know, that at the end of Magnolia, something significant is going to bring all these things together. This movie doesn't do that. So at no point am I watching this film thinking, how do all these people connect? In fact, I don't fucking care how these people connect, and that's a bigger problem. But I'm not even thinking that it's going to reveal something at the end. Like, it's just not even in the DNA of the movie. It's just really fucking strange. And then it does have these weird reveals. Let's talk for a second, please, about the Madeline Stowe, Anthony Edwards storyline of this movie.
Is this the priest storyline?
The minister.
Yes.
But yeah, no priest.
Well, that's another reveal.
Yeah.
There was a line, so you know, that's the vignette where there's a woman and a man who are having an affair. The man is just constantly, like, every scene he's like, so should we get married or something? And she's like, nah, I really just like having sex with you, and I don't like you as a person, and I don't want to be around you otherwise, is basically what she's saying. But he keeps bringing it up. And then there's a line that really bothered me at the end when the reveal was that he was a minister, because he says something along the lines of like, well, I know that you love your husband. And she says, well, I know you love your girlfriend more. And I think the girlfriend was intended to be God.
Yeah.
And I hated then seeing his little like priest thing on, and I was like, is this a joke? I was like, and it was extremely upsetting. The whole thing was extremely upsetting.
It's terrible.
Like his reaction to her, her just being like, I really don't like you. I just want to fuck you. Like, yeah. Please leave me alone. And then that she's married to Dennis Quaid.
Yeah.
And that the reason she wants to be with Dennis Quaid is because a random person says, you must have a really great imagination. And then she starts crying. As if this is the most powerful sentence she's heard in her life, and it changes the course of her marriage and the fact that she's been fucking this minister who just married her parents. It's a lot.
It's
did I accurately read?
No, you absolutely.
That?
Everything you said is completely the way it goes down. We find out that Dennis Quaid is a video game creator. And that he created a game called Killer Golf that Ryan Felipe really loves. And
Killer Golf.
And I mean, it's, and he says, you have a really amazing imagination. And to your, and as Aaron just said, Madeline Stowe starts crying and then they go dancing together. And we're led to believe that their marriage is going to be fine.
Ostensibly, they're back together.
As they play architecture in the background.
Correct. Yes.
Let's talk a little bit about it. Let's talk about a little bit about Killer Golf here.
Yeah, yeah. What do you think happens in Killer Golf, Kenny?
I have no fucking idea.
Golf balls to the head.
Obviously, to the head. Murdering people with golf clubs.
Yeah. And one of a million things going to happen. You know, yep. Blank canvas there. I hate the idea that fucking middle-aged boomers, because this guy is very much a boomer, yes. Somehow came up with a game called Killer Golf. 0% yeah. chance.
Zero. Less than zero.
Less than zero.
Also that Ryan Felipe would then be like, you are so creative.
Because me with my
just
blue
based
hair
off of the title.
And my rave drugs, I just go home and play Killer Golf every night. I really have always kind of hated video game people in movies. It always has been like some really ugly kind of shorthand that is used in lieu of actual character development and also makes the video game. Now, I'm not really a gamer, but like I understand it's a real thing where that people really care about. And it always does stupid shit like Killer Golf. Like, don't you like they always this is what those kids like golf, but
the kids are playing right.
Disembowel
golf, but it kills people.
Yeah,
golf, but instead of golf balls, it's eyeballs, and instead of golf clubs, it's femurs. And
that's probably what Killer Golf is. That sounds right, Kenny. That sounds
eyeballs.
Right.
Yes,
eyeballs and limbs. Yeah,
yeah.
Maybe to be part of Killer Golf, it's like you have to be a serial killer who's also a golfer, and then on the like holes, each hole is a kill.
That's right. Cool. I like
that
too.
Let's do this, Aaron. I think it's too bad we're 3,000 episodes into this podcast, because a good feature would have been let's write a movie every episode. We've done like six or seven episodes.
Yeah. Okay.
The PGA Tour professional / serial killer. What? Like, it's like American Psycho, but he goes from town to town, kills people with a fucking golf club, dresses like a yuppie. The amount of privilege those dudes have.
You guys should write
this
fucking
movie. And no one would suspect him.
And we call
no one would suspect them.
Yeah.
Okay.
No one suspect them.
The Dexter reboot's coming out. There's a thirst for serial killers again.
Always
this is going to sell.
People love it.
This is going to sell.
This is a legitimately good idea for a movie, though, guys. Like,
I know.
Well, playing by heart, leading to genius.
Playing by heart, and now we're writing a movie.
It kind of has like, it's the kind of movie you'd make in like the 80s or 90s. Like, Phil, when we do like Death Spa and Society, I think it kind of fits into that a little bit.
Yep.
Like, look, nostalgia is huge right now. Okay?
Always.
This is going to fit.
I'm gonna put Killer Golf on my big board.
Put on your board,
Aaron. And if you want to write, Phil, of course you're welcome.
Yeah, no, I would love to. I'd love to be involved.
I'd like all three of us to write it, because I think that's a recipe for success based on our obviously. Brendan Fraser resurgence here, our renaissance.
No joke. Obviously, he would star. That's a good fucking star for this.
That's a great star for this.
He's a little too old.
My life has come full circle.
He'd have to be on the Champions Tour, the senior tour.
Yeah.
Sure.
But I still think that's pretty good. He's been doing it for fucking 30 years.
Maybe we can pull like a John, like in Dexter season 2, when there was like Lithgow. another serial killer. Maybe he could be the John Lithgow character. Sure. And then
wouldn't it be such a great moment when the young hot detective realizes that all these murders are happening in towns with PGA Tour events? It's like, what is the? They What's all have the, a country.
What is club. The connection?
Yeah. You know, I was just listening to my new favorite podcast, The Heist Podcast. I don't know if you guys
I've heard of it. I haven't listened.
It is the best. But one thing that they note is good heisters, really good heisters, move around a lot. Because these local police departments don't really talk to each other. And it isn't until the FBI gets involved that they really even stand a chance. Because the FBI starts, you know, pooling together this information from all these different jurisdictions. So if our PGA Tour killer golf serial killer is killing people wherever there's a tour
event, would suspect them the golfer?
Very long time.
Who would suspect?
No one
suspects. I can't fucking wait.
The bodies go in the golf bag. That's how he gets rid of them. He
carries them up. And all of it, and all of his golf clubs made out of bones.
Made of bone.
What's harder than bone?
That's amazing. I want to.
That's how he's so good.
I want to ask a question to get back to playing by heart for a quick second here, because there are some. I don't want to say twist. Twists are the wrong word, but there are some plot mechanics that kind of made my head hurt. I want to specifically hone in on the Angelina Jolie Ryan Felipe storyline. She meets this guy in a rave, and
did they know each other before? I was not clear on.
No. Okay. She just is screaming on a screaming on a payphone in a rave, as
one
does.
And he was giving her quarters or something?
He gave her a quarter so she could yell at her ex about the cat that she wanted back from him.
Blanche.
I guess it's supposed to be a meet cute. Then they chat at like a table. Like, again, like this bar club rave situation that's all kind of it's a skeleton key. It doesn't matter.
It looks like it was left over from the Mod Squad set.
Yes, it does. It very much does. So Angelina Jolie immediately falls in love with this guy, like is immediately head over heels. He seems less than enamored with her and yet subjects himself to numerous dates with her.
That's a real time capsule right there, by the way. A world where Angelina Jolie is pining after Ryan Felipe and everybody's just down because like he was like as it as they got.
Yes.
I had a poster of him in my room growing up from Cruel Intentions. It was like with his sunglasses down. And I was watching those scenes being like, trying to remember why I liked him because
he's so boring in this movie.
I love
and
him.
I was
really? Even.
Okay.
Well, look, wow, I love him in general. Obviously, I love Sebastian, one of my favorite characters.
Well, that is like the character he was made to play.
Correct.
But this it's like he is really flat. I felt like his deliveries are really flat. Yeah. Of the lines, and I like, especially compared to Angelina, I was like, what does she see in him? I was like, what do I see in him? Well, but there were moments, he's a beautiful man. There were moments where I was like, oh, I understand.
Well, it feels like he had one direction, which was the reveal that he's HIV positive, and that he overplayed the or however you want to call it, this sort of this reticence to be attached to Angelina Jolie, and unfortunately that plays as boredom, that plays as a flatness, as opposed to trying to keep his emotions to himself. So there's this push and pull of like, why is this guy continuing to go on these dates with this girl? The answer being, of course, he is into her, but he's afraid to be into her because of the fact that he's HIV positive, which
good reason.
It's not a bad reason, but it's also like, it's just it's just acted poorly, unfortunately. But then in the middle of this, Angelina Jolie's car is stolen in a parking lot. But it turns out that her sister, played by Gillian Anderson, stole the car for her so that it looked like her car was stolen. And then Ryan Phillippe knew that her car had been stolen and was like, I knew it was all fake.
Yeah.
Like, what?
But that's a classic move. That's the classic first date move. So obviously Ryan.
That's how Kenny is actually married today. That's how Kenny met Laura.
Yeah.
Well, Laura also has, I mean, Laura has three sisters they have pulled some shit. So it is not that crazy.
Well, okay. I'm not saying that we don't have friends or siblings that are willing to help us in situations,
of course, Phil.
But this is absurd. Yeah. It's unfortunate. It's weird. But to sort of what we were alluding to earlier, they're both so beautiful and so watchable on some level that this storyline rises above the rest, and it's still rife with problems.
I also want to say I wrote down a number of her outfits in the movie that I was like, this is an incredible outfit. Her gold long sleeve fingerless gloves. I was like, I need these immediately. I was into that,
but were you into the weird head scarf thing?
I thought that was hilarious because I was like, this is, I guess, the director's version of like what a quirky girl would be wearing.
Right.
Like with the curlers also, like he had her in curlers a lot.
And just busting out of shirts, just straight up like wearing a bra, it just seemed like was just...
Yeah. Amazing. For me, amazing.
It definitely is a time capsule in terms of their storyline reminded me a little bit of Go, Kenny, in terms of the rave culture, the aesthetic that kind of goes with rave culture, the colored hair.
It's really a shame that, I mean, you know, I don't really know where I stand on Go right now, to be honest.
The movie you went to see literally twice back to back.
I did. And it was my favorite movie for so long. And then we did it for this podcast. And I guess I was just in a bad mood. But like, or I don't know what was wrong with me. Like I still
we kind of laid into Go. We really laid into at least the second and third act. We loved the first act.
Yes, we were jerks. It's a real shame that there really isn't a outside of Go. I guess like a seminal rave movie because that was a massive part of the culture. That
I totally agree.
What about Fear? Do you remember the movie Fear with Reese Witherspoon?
That's the seminal getting to third base on a roller coaster movie.
that's true, but anytime I think
of a rave, I think of that movie because
really,
yeah, they go, that's like where she meets what's his face,
Mark Wahlberg.
Thank you. Yeah. They meet at a rave and he like saves her from the rave like getting raided by police.
So, Kenny, you make a good point about rave culture and how I think part of it is that it was very brief, it feels like. Like, it didn't last that long.
But it was exactly when I was, like...
Totally.
Experimenting with shit. So, it like, for me, maybe for, like... It must be just people who are, like, exactly our age. Mm-hmm. But it was, like, the moment. It was, like, a 2 or 3 year thing that, like... it was almost like pre-EDM. Right?
Yes.
Like EDM took over around 2003, 2004, and then never stopped. And now EDM is basically, you know, EDM slash hip hop is what popular music has become. But there was this moment right before where it was much scarier.
Yes.
Far druggier. Mm-hmm. Like raves weren't dangerous. They never ended. You know, you started, you walked out and the sun was up.
Yeah.
It did have this like end of the world vibe.
Well, it's interesting. Two things are interesting about what you're saying. The first is I just watched the Woodstock 99 documentary on HBO the other day, which I highly recommend watching.
And we'll be doing an episode.
We'll do an episode on it. But there's a portion of it where they had like a rave tent. And it just didn't close. It was just 24 hours a day, just, you know, sun up, sun down, just people, I'm assuming, rolling and raving and doing whatever they're doing in there. It's interesting. We are going to touch on a filmmaker that I do feel tried to kind of weaponize that culture a little bit, which is Greg Araki. He had a group of films around that time. certainly from the aesthetics and certainly that kind of subculture, we're going to do Splendor at some point. And but to your grander point, Kenny, there really isn't that movie, and Go is kind of that movie, for good or bad. But I do think that Angelina Jolie and Ryan Felipe's storyline in this film is sort of trafficking in that culture a bit, not really, but kind of.
Yeah, they tried to.
Yeah, we've seen a bunch of movies that feel like they were made or production designed by people who were aware of rave culture.
Yes.
But now,
did you feel that this was the case?
I do. I think this was a bit. This had a bit of like, this is what the kids are doing these days, right? Yeah. Like, I mean, off the top of my head, though, I mean, the Mod Squad is like the biggest one that kind of played there. End of Days kind of played there a little bit. Stigmata kind of played there a little bit. Like a lot of these things that were kind of dealing with the end of the world also felt like rave music and rave culture was the soundtrack and the setting for the end of the world.
But it's also kissing up against your Limp Bizkits and your Korns and stuff like that in terms of that like end of the world.
I can't figure out what that was.
We're going to have to at some point, Kenny. We need to, wrestle it at some point.
I don't get it. Like I know that there's this idea that you can draw a straight line from the Limp Bizkits and the Korn, like the Limp Bizkit people and the Korn people to like the Trump people. Yeah. But that's not what it was. The straight line to me is MMA culture to the Trump people, right? And MMA culture to me is not really married to any kind of artistic aesthetic aside from t-shirts with shit all over the t-shirt. Like,
I hear that.
I don't know what that is, but that's not really Limp Bizkit or Kid Rock.
Well, I do think that the HBO documentary, which I highly recommend you guys check out, does try to unpack how we got there and how sort of grunge mutated and was sort of and a bunch of different types of music were co-opted and kind of put into this weird stew, and that's how you get your Limp Bizkits and your Korns. But it's strange.
What a thing that we've gone down this road. I was like, of all the things we're going to talk about here today, will it be MMA culture? Will
will Playing by Heart get us to MMA? I don't know. I will ask this, though. It's because it is on the music tip that we're talking about here. The Drinking in L.A. by Bram Van 3000 needle drop at the top of this movie did take me back, because that's a song I have not heard since 1999. It was... It's a weird, and it does speak to your point, Kenny, of a booyah base of music that creates a song like that, that's sort of trip-hoppy, kind of rappy, but also pop. Like, it's trying to do all these things. Because I do think that the millennium, whether we want to kind of wrestle that or not, does feel like it's bringing out all this shit, right? Like, it's... Everyone's like, it's about to be the year 2000. Like, let's jam everything together, and who the fuck knows what's going to happen?
Yeah,
it's weird. It's
only now, after watching every fucking movie made in this year and having 20 plus years of distance from it, does it actually feel like it was a really, really, really important thing? Like that 99 to 2000 thing. Mm-hmm. Did have this Magnolia vibe, right? Yeah. Did have this like the world's about to end.
Think
vibe.
About Blast from the Past, the movie that we reviewed. Yeah. I mean, that was all about end of time.
And Y2K is part of this too. We're going to do a Y2K episode at one point as well, because I feel like we laugh about it now, but at the time, it felt pretty real. Like
it was scary, felt like
there were people that were thinking, I don't know what's going to happen. My everything might not work. Technology might shut down and we might be back to the Stone Ages until we figure it out.
What's so weird about it? I mean, I wonder what kind of person, who the analog is for someone who was truly terrified of Y2K. because this is not the same.
Probably the same people who like are not getting vaxxed, and
you think they're QAnon
that kind
people?
Of thing.
So I don't think I so because I think there's way I more. I think there's I maybe I'm wrong, but like I almost think it's the people who took COVID very seriously. Because, like, I think that there was way more evidence that this might happen. Like, really, like,
I think actual smart people
were like, this might happen.
No, smart people were scared. But I don't think, like, I think there were people who actually, like, had bunkers ready to go.
Yes. There
like,
were doomsdayers,
those are the people
for sure.
I'm thinking yes. about. Yeah.
So the thing is, like, okay, the QAnon people. Have believed for
what are we talking about?
I was just gonna say from playing my heart to QAnon.
I don't know why you guys are trying to get back to this stupid ass movie when we could talk about QAnon.
Well, I mean
the QAnon people, for instance, there was a date, right, in March where like the great storm reckoning flood where Trump was supposed to come back, and that didn't happen. And the QAnon people were just like, well, yeah, it just got postponed to August, right? Mm-hmm. Like their prophecy didn't come true and it just got postponed. But again, this isn't like some like Nostradamus thing or some, you know, ancient Mayan prophecy where like you can kind of be like, I think we might have just interpreted this wrong. Now this is some shit now. Like you're wrong. Right? Do you like the Y2K people all were like, great news, didn't happen. But do you think there would have been a segment of people who were like, actually, it's going to be Y2K1? Actually,
I'm
like,
sure there were. I'm sure there were. It's like those religious or cult leaders who are like, you know, every year they're like, okay, this is the doomsday year. We got to, like, and then when it passes, they're like, oh, they changed the date.
The
it's
thing
a little
about
farther
Y2K
down the road.
That's just different is this had nothing to do with like tribalism. It had nothing to do with like.
I think there were people in tech who were like.
Yes. This was science. This was actual like. This was actually like, look, and who knows, but it seems like if the, you know, the Peters from Office Space didn't sit in their cubicle and change all the four digits to two digits, we might have actually gone back to the Stone Age. Yes. So thank you, Peter from Inatech.
Yes, no, I understand. I want to pivot for a second because there's
Sean Connery.
There's two other storylines we do need to hit before we rate this movie and move on with our lives. The first is the Sean Connery, Gina Rowlands storyline. Sean Connery thought about having an affair 25 years ago.
Basically, it seems like he's married to like a Martha Stewart kind of lady who has her own
show. Ida Gardner is
what
she felt like to me. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And she discovers an old photo that we don't really get context for right away, but she's pissed. She's like going through his things. She finds this old photo buried in his last will and testament.
Correct.
And she's like,
because he's dying.
He's got a brain tumor.
He's dying.
Tumor. Yeah.
And she's like, hey, bitch, I found this photo. Guess what? Mama's pissed off. Okay.
Yeah, that's basically it. Yeah.
And Sean is like, I didn't sleep with her. He's like, did fall in love with her.
Which
no
is worse.
Biggie. But
Wouldn't
he's like, but guess what?
Worse?
I loved you more. Oh,
yeah, but
totally.
Like,
it's
of
like,
course
he's
it's worse.
Basically like, I was in love with both of you, but I liked you a little bit more, so I didn't sleep with her. It wasn't worth it. And she's kind of like,
actually thing.
Well, okay.
Yeah. Yes, it is. It's like Love Actually. Yeah.
Yeah.
Emma Thompson lays
great.
It out perfectly. It's
but
you know,
their storyline is kind of played for like laughs a lot, I feel like. And it was confusing, but I did love their house. I took many notes on their house. I was like, I wonder how much this would sell for. I was like, in this economy, a lot.
Oh, it's a beautiful home. In the
really
right location.
Home. Oh, vaulted ceilings. Home. They've got a pool in LA. My God. Speaking of homes, did you notice that Jon Stewart was living in the Stahl house?
Yeah. Yep.
This is like a famous architectural house in LA. He was living in it. And as soon as I saw it, I was like, the Stahl house? I was like, well, I would be very interested in Jon Stewart too if he took me back to the Stahl house.
Yeah.
A lot of great architecture in this movie.
There is some good architecture in this movie.
And dancing.
It's true. I do think the Sean Connery, Gina Roland storyline is weird too, because it's filled with all these weird movie references. Like, it's just jammed with him continuing to ruin.
He says mission accomplished at one point.
He does. He does.
And I was like, I'm not super familiar with like all of the, but I was like, surely he said that and as a Bond dude, right?
Correct. A Bond dude.
I was like,
a previous Bond dude.
I'm not very invested, but I was like, that's a weird nod to him being Bond in this movie.
They also did, I mean, they didn't really have much chemistry, if I'm being completely honest.
No. That's not what this was about for them.
It's interesting to me watching that storyline and knowing how invested in this film Sean Connery was. Like that this guy was kind of at the tip of the spear of this film. It seemed like he felt like this was going to be a movie that was going to, you know, was there Oscar potential? Like that this was going to be a movie that was just going to be more...
Or maybe change the roles that he got?
Yeah, I really don't know. I know that he did talk about how he was interested in doing it because it was an age-appropriate relationship, but then like he goes right into Entrapment, which is the worst, most egregious.
Yeah.
So like, fuck that noise. But so that storyline is whatever. The final storyline that we're talking about, and we briefly kind of grazed it earlier, which is the Gillian Anderson-John Stewart relationship. Gillian Anderson is a theater director whose play looks terrible. I mean, straight up.
I did write down, I was like, awful. And what is this play about? Because I see a chef, I see a flapper. And I was like, how are they connected? And it was made like me a think about chef and someone in a flapper uniform.
It made me think about Margot Tenenbaum's plays from the Royal Tenenbaums. Where it was just
those
like,
are good plays.
Those are much better plays.
Yes, I like
but
those
I was just like, what is this play? So she's a theater director. She frequents a bookstore, it seems, because she seems to be a regular there. Michael Emerson works there.
There's an architect there redoing the bookstore. And yes. He makes bookshelves that fall on people. So he's
she
not
tries
a very
to
good
reach
architect.
For a magazine, and the whole bookshelf comes down on her.
Yeah.
It's a gigantic bookshelf that would have crushed her and probably killed her.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
But she gets up, dusts herself off, and she's totally fine. John Stewart is
And then he
the
asks
architect?
Her on a date, Phil.
He's the architect.
Yes.
He's the architect.
He's the architect.
Making the bookshelves that fall on people. And he then asks her on a date when she brushes herself off.
Yeah, yeah.
This was our, so as we said, this was 1 week before 1999. John Stewart starts on The Daily Show in 1999.
Yep.
Oh.
So it's interesting to think that he was maybe, you know, let's assume he never got The Daily Show. I mean, he had the John Stewart Show, which was a bit of a failure. Mm-hmm. Like he was not cool at this time.
No.
He
saw this movie and he thought, this isn't working out. He was like, I should go
to Basic Cable.
Yeah.
Which is what I should go replace an old SportsCenter guy on Basic Cable.
And revolutionize television.
I know. And then become like the world's, biggest fucking celebrity, which he also did. But this is the only period in John Stewart's entire career where he was, scraping the bottom of the barrel. And yet I still feel like he was the most watchable part of this. I think this guy has always radiated like a certain star power and charisma. He still has it and intelligence.
I still think Angelina was the most watchable, but I thought he was good. And there was a scene with him where he's like cuddling with her enormous dog that I thought was really like charming and showed his comedy very well.
Mm-hmm. With the exception
he was good in it, but I kept wondering, I was like, why Gillian? Why? And Gillian is obviously a queen, and why wouldn't you love her? But in this movie, they made her deeply, that's true.
And this goes kind of for everybody. Most of the people in this film are sleepwalking through these performances. Like they're just
I don't know if I agree with that. I feel like they did the best. Okay. I don't know. I mean, it's you can chalk it up to like this ephemeral notion of star power.
Right.
But
right.
I felt like all the people in this movie who were stars, with the exception of Dennis Quaid, gave star performances. Maybe with the exception, maybe you wouldn't include Ryan Felipe in there, but I don't know if you'd ever really call him a star. But even Ellen Burstyn, I think Jay Moore did the best with some of the worst material you'll ever see. I think Angelina was great. I think John Stewart was great. I thought Madeline Stowe was great. I think Sean Connery was really good. Again, this movie's terrible, but like these characters, these actors, you know, were kind of able to land this plane with only one death, Dennis Quaid.
There's only one death in this movie.
Only one person was murdered.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I don't disagree with you in the sense that what kills these actors is the script, right? Like, they just don't have good stuff to do. They're doing the best they can with what they have. And because the script is so flat, it's making the character, and it's also poorly directed. So, like, I believe that there's a more dynamic Gillian Anderson performance to be made from this material. I just feel like, you know, there's just not a lot going on there. And to your earlier point, Aaron, there is something a little bit unseemly about how continually Jon Stewart is coming at this woman who's, again, this is a trope of, obviously, of the 90s and what have you, of men that just think that male writers that think it's cute that the chase and the perpetual, like, what have you. I've talked about it a fair amount on the West Wing episodes as well. It's a trope of Sorkin's for sure. So it's a problem.
I think Willard Carroll thinks that's part of courtship, because it's just, it's gender reversed in the Angelina storyline, right?
Yeah.
He doesn't, this is a trope of male writers. This is a trope of female writers. This is a trope of everybody before a certain period of time where people in general, men, people in general didn't really understand in terms of narrative storytelling, how uncomfortable it is to have somebody ask over and over and over again, and how maybe the second time it starts to verge on harassment and the third or fourth time it is harassment.
Correct.
So I don't think people really got that. And
I agree.
Again, you know, Willard Carroll seems to think that by flipping it gender, he might. I think he thinks that he's covering his ass a little bit. But
they also had a really quick. It was like she was deflecting him over and over again. I think they have dinner successfully where she had agreed to a dinner maybe once or twice, and she's like, I'm in love, and then he's staying at her house watching her dog, and then it feels like they're about to get married very quickly. And it, like, if we're going by Dennis Quaid's storyline where he has a week to like hit all of these characters and then he attends a wedding or whatever, I'm not clear on the length of time happening in this movie at all.
Yeah, it definitely, to your point, it's one of two things, which is A, the passage of time doesn't make any sense. And if it is as compressed as it seems to be, these people are acting insane and these relationships are getting dialed up way too quickly. So it's all kind of insane. Let's rate this film. Let's rate this movie. I really hated this movie. And one of the things that bothered me the most about this film, and it's something we talked about on another film that I really disliked, The Story of Us, which is wasted potential. The possibility of a cast, and I'm similar to yourself, Kenny, I'm a big fan of relationship movies, big ensemble-y relationship things, the interconnectedness of life. I love all of that stuff. And this film fucking sucks at that, and it bothers me. And Story of Us, similarly, it wasn't so much about the interconnectedness of life and a mosaic or what have you, but that movie was about sort of, you know, unpacking a marriage over the course of many years. And I think that they failed at doing that as well. So I kind of equate them similarly in my head. Anyway, before this podcast, I gave it a 20. After this podcast, I'm up a little bit, maybe a 25 if I'm being generous, but that's kind of where I'm at. What about you, Kenny?
I actually was higher than you before this podcast. I gave it a 35. I mean, that's a bad rating for a bad movie. I find it not so terrible.
Okay.
I'm down a little bit. I'm going to go down to a 30. even, because I think in final analysis, I'm a little more offended by the by the structure of this film than I thought I was. I had already previously accounted for how poorly every individual storyline was executed, but I think 30. This is not the worst film we've done. There is a professional veneer to the way this was made, and you do have all these stars. It's just trite and dumb and a little sad, but whatever. It's a film. What do you think, Aaron?
Yeah, what are you at, Aaron?
Well, I feel like I'm a little bit more on Kenny's side of the fence here, because I would not rewatch this movie, but I can think of worse movies, I think, if I try hard enough. Sure. And so probably before this, I would have rated it like a 35, like right around where Kenny is. But then with us discussing it, then you realize really how bad it is. So maybe I'll go down to a 25 after this. Really would not rewatch it, like under any circumstances.
And definitely tell people not to watch it. Like, I would go out of my way to make sure people do.
I think I've already seen you do that on Twitter.
Yeah, I've been pretty clear. You've been like,
"Wow, this is terrible."
You were pretty hard at it.
Yeah, I really didn't like this movie.
But I think I liked it less after we talked about it for sure.
So Kenny, next week, you and I talked about a film that we both had never seen, that we both really came around on and really loved, to try to combat the movie that we just talked about, which we didn't like very much. I don't know if you've seen this film, Aaron. It's called Limbo.
It's so good.
It's a John Sayles movie starring David Strathairn, Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio. It's a fucking great movie. And we both were just a nice palate cleanser.
You should watch it. I would advise everyone to watch it.
I think you'd really like it's essentially about these people that get the shitty pitches, they get stranded in the woods, but it's so much more than that.
What's the genre?
Oh boy, it's kind of got sort of thrillery vibes a little bit. Okay. But it's really more of a meditation on
for the first half of the movie, it's a romance between two people who are kind of over the hill a little bit in Alaska, and then
that's up my alley.
Shit happens
from there.
I think
unexpected shit happens. And as Phil said, they kind of get stranded in the woods, and it's fucking great. It is the opposite of this movie because it is the kind of because obviously John Sayles isn't writing specs at this point in his career, but it has the vibe of a really good spec.
You're telling me two people can have a conversation in this movie, makes sense.
They can talk to each other. Yes.
Wow.
It has the vibe of like, I have an interesting idea for a movie. What if you had two people who are like starting on a relationship, and then something really kind of traumatic and scary happens to them at the same time, where they have to depend on each other in a way they're not prepared to do yet emotionally. And then all of the specifics about all of the plot mechanisms and the specifics and the characterizations are really strong, and the performances are like incredible. You know, it's our second, we did The Abyss with Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio. So it's our second movie with her. David Strathairn is in it. Okay. Chris Christopherson is awesome. It's just a good fucking movie.
And David Strathairn is just, I mean, he's one of our finest actors. He's fucking great. Limbo rules. Watch Limbo. But more than anything, Aaron, thank you so, so much for coming on and talking about Playing by Heart.
This is a lot of fun, and I wouldn't have watched that movie otherwise. So thank you.
Of course. And we hope to have you back
soon. Now I'll never have to rewatch it. Yeah.
There you go.
Nope. You took the bullet for all of America and Canada.
Thank you so much, Aaron. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
One last thing, please rate, review, and subscribe. Speaking of subscribing, check out our Patreon on all the best films of 1989, Batman, When Harry Met Sally, Fabulous Baker Boys, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, Field of Dreams, Major League, and many, many more. We are covering all the best films of 1989 with amazing guests like Joanna Robinson, Liz Hanna, Hunter Covington, Brian Cogman, David Iserson, and many, many more. All your favorite guests from our 1999 podcast are coming on to the 1989 Patreon. You can sign up for it at patreon.com/podcastlikeits1989. For only $5, you get access to all of these awesome episodes. And for a few bucks more, you get video of our 1999 episodes as well. Plus, there are other very cool tiers too, where you can even be a guest on our podcast. Please check out our Reddit as well at reddit.com/podcastlikeits. We're also on Twitter at podcastlikeits1999. We're also on Instagram at podcastlikeits1999. Thank you so much to Ernie and Will for producing our episodes, Sullivan for our social media, Jan Katas for our amazing art and theme songs, and most of all, thank you all for listening.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.